It is Monday, March the 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, suicide attack by splinter group in Pakistan.
This is the faction which has broken ties with the main Pakistani Taliban, but it has claimed responsibility. And the spokesman clearly said that the target of the bomber was actually the Christian community.
Also ahead, Syria's ancient city of Palmyra recaptured from Islamic State, plus U.S. reaction to deadly blast in Belgium. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Pakistani officials say a bomb blast at a crowded park in the eastern city of Lahore killed at least 65, wounded hundreds more, many of them women and children. Our reporter, Ayaz Gul, spoke with my colleague Jim Stevenson late Sunday about the bombing and the significance of where it took place.
Well, this is a very famous park in the city. And in fact, it was Easter today, and most of members of the Christian community, they were also present with their kids. And apparently, a suicide bomber struck the area of the park where mostly kids were playing with their parents. And what we have so far is that at least 70 people have died in this massive explosion, and more than 350 people have been wounded. The latest information is that more than 100 of them are really seriously wounded, and doctors are struggling to save their lives. So there are fears that death toll is likely to increase.
We have information saying that perhaps the Pakistani Taliban was responsible for this.
We received a phone call from a spokesman for a splinter faction of the Pakistani Taliban. I mean, it used to be part of the Pakistani Taliban, which has been waging this insurgency against the state here. But this is the faction which has broken ties with the main Pakistani Taliban, but it has claimed responsibility. And the spokesman clearly said that the target of the bomber was actually the Christian community. And it was well planned, and they knew that today is Easter, and most of the Christian community members, they flood this park. So that's what the spokesman claimed, but obviously it's very difficult to verify these kind of claims. Yeah, it was quite a devastating incident that happened in Pakistan, and a meeting of the top civilian and political, civilian and military leadership has ended. It was like a four-hour meeting where this incident was debated, and instructions have been issued to try to quickly identify and bring to justice those who were responsible or who facilitated this attack.
Lahore has been subject to several attacks over the past couple of years. What would the security be like in that area, knowing that it's Easter and the Christians would be congregating at that time?
Well, this is the most populous province of Pakistan, Punjab province, I mean, of which Lahore is the capital city. And usually the security is tight, and the Pakistani Taliban has mostly targeted places in northwestern Pakistan. This is eastern Pakistan. An attack on Punjab, which is basically the political bastion, and which is actually really the 60% of Pakistan, is a serious blow to the efforts that the Pakistani army has been making to really uproot bases of these militants in the northwestern country. So it shows that they are really still capable of carrying out these kind of massive attacks. But we are hearing from the authorities is that because the operations to uproot bases and training facilities of these terrorists in northwestern Pakistan near the border with Afghanistan have been so successful that now these militants who are, according to officials, on the run are now trying to hit these soft targets like public places. And that's what the officials are saying, that it demonstrates the frustration on part of the militants. But again, it's quite a massive incident and massive attack. And this is going to have a serious impact on all the efforts the government has been making to improve security so that economy, the struggling economy, could be improved and more investment could be attracted to the country. But that is quite a massive attack. And we see the coverage of this bombing on local television channels has been so massive that it has really created a psychological impact, and obviously it will have its implications for all the efforts the government has been making to improve security and economy especially.
That is reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. He was speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Well, that splinter group, that is, the Pakistan Taliban that Ayaz just mentioned, is known as the Jamaatul Aror, and we asked Ohio State University scholar Alam Payan to tell us about this particular Taliban faction.
Jamaatul Ahrar is a branch of the Tehreek-e-Taliban in Pakistan, which is the Pakistan's movement of Taliban. So that's a totally a different group than the Afghan Taliban. So this is a Pakistani group, mostly from the northwest frontier area, and they are in Punjab too, in sections of the Balochistan. So this is an active Pakistani Taliban group, and they have claimed the responsibility for this. And it was usually in a park in Lahore, which is the capital of Punjab province, and Christians and Muslims combined. This is a park that everyone goes there. And so that it was a suicidal bombing, and the head of the person that who committed this suicidal bombing was found. So this is one of the very bad incidences in Pakistan.
And Dr. Payan went on to talk about the targets of Sunday's blast in Lahore.
This Taliban group are targeting not only the Christians, they're targeting Hindus. Some of Hindus are living in Pakistan. And also they are targeting the Shiites, Muslims, which are a branch of the Shia Muslims in Pakistan too. So this is a group that it has been condemned by the Pakistani government and all Muslim majority countries, and including India. Also, they send their condolences to Pakistan. So this is a terrorist group, just like this ISIS or Daesh, which has no public support in any one of these countries, and they are just this extremist jihadi groups, so to speak. And they have no support from any one of these 57 Muslim majority countries, neither the Taliban of Pakistan nor this ISIL or Daesh groups, which are active in the Middle East.
Alam Payan is a scholar at Ohio State University. Now let's turn to what's being said in the world of social media about the Pakistan blast. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here. You know, G., I understand that hashtag Pakistan has been used hundreds of times on Twitter in the last day. It's growing by the hour, and we've even heard from some of those running for president.
Hi, Steve. Two U.S. presidential hopefuls tweeted about it. Here's John Kasich on the Republican side. He wrote, "Let us remember the victims as we gather strength and resolve to defeat all who threaten our values." More than 400 people liked that tweet. Democratic contender Bernie Sanders wrote, "We are grieving today for the families affected by the deplorable attack in Lahore. No one should ever fear taking their children to a park." More than 6,000 people liked that tweet. On the hashtag front, hashtag Pakistan has been used in nearly 300,000 tweets around the world, and that number is increasing by the hour.
Wasn't there a commotion on Facebook about a bug, something like that? What's that all about?
There was. So Facebook's safety check feature didn't work properly earlier Sunday, and people are having a lively conversation about it. The safety check feature is a notification activated following a bombing or a natural disaster in a specific area. So if you happen to be in that area, you get to check whether you're safe or not, which will then let your Facebook friends know about your status. But on Sunday, notifications were sent out to people outside of the affected area, and that was quite confusing to a lot of people outside of Pakistan. Even I got that notification this morning, so Facebook sent out a statement on Naturally, Facebook, and apologized for the confusion.
So what did that statement say exactly?
It clarified that asking people not affected by the crisis whether they're okay is counter to the intent of the safety check product, and the issue is now resolved.
And I'd love to know what the lively conversation entailed.
Most people are quite understanding about the incident. One Facebook user replied, "I got the same thing and I'm in Oklahoma, just a bit out of the area, but I don't mind. I'm glad you care, Facebook. Now, that reply got more than 80 likes. Other people wrote, "You don't have to apologize. This service has proven to be invaluable many times since it was implemented." But of course, there are some people who are always a bit more critical about things than others. One person wrote, "You, referring to Facebook, hope the people in the area of the explosion find safety check a useful and helpful way to let your friends and family know they're okay." So what you're really saying is, we intentionally made our product malfunction for free advertising in the wake of a bombing. Many people actually found that tweet to be a bit of a stretch, and that reply got a lot of replies defending Facebook. Back to you.
And many thanks, Yuji. That's our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. Thanks for being here. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. Still ahead, a big gain against the Islamic State in Syria. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Salih saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad says the recapture of the ancient city of Palmyra by government forces backed by Russian airstrikes is an important achievement. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Portland State University scholar Peter Bechtol if this is a mortal blow to the Islamic State, as some have observed.
Not yet. I think it is a wound, and how large a wound we don't know, because you know, Palmyra has two functions. One of them is of course, for the Western world, or the world, I should say, it is a world cultural heritage site with 2,000-year-old artifacts. And any damage, is something that gives very bad publicity to the rest of the world. However, you know, from a purist point of view, that heritage was also what is known as idolatry. You know, for those with the strictest interpretation, and those are no more than 5 to 10% of the Muslims. But, you know, it is so losing that part is not so important. More important for ISIL is that Tadmur is the a local name of the city, is also the place where the government's worst prison has been located. And for decades, I remember reading about Tadmur is where all those opposing the Assad regime, the current Assad and his father, Hafez, used to send their political prisoners, and reportedly they were tortured there. So the recapture of this is more important militarily to the government than the loss of Palmyra to ISIS, because it's in the middle of nowhere. It's surrounded by desert. So it can be a military outpost, but, you know, it is not like losing something along the Euphrates River or the Tigris River. That strategically would be more of a mortal wound.
Some of the temples and artifacts in Palmyra were damaged or destroyed.
Yes.
But the government is promising to rebuild. They say this has happened before throughout history. Can Palmyra be rebuilt?
I think so. I mean, from what I'm looking at right now, there are about 7 or 8 pictures. It shows most of the columns are standing upright. And in the museum, there are some very interesting artifacts, which also seem to be fine. On the other hand, there is inscribed in Arabic, now that is with a spray can, it is forbidden by the emir to come in here. So who knows who did this? It could have been the ISIL people or it could have been somebody else. There's an area that is clearly damaged. But, you know, not far away is Baalbek in eastern Lebanon, and I've been there, and a lot of that was destroyed over history, and it is still worth visiting. And if you consider the artifacts in Egypt that have been destroyed over the centuries and have been rebuilt after the Napoleonic invasions. So it is possible to recover that from a world culture point of view.
The Syrian military command said its gains showed that the army, quote, and its friends are the only force able to uproot terrorism. How big a boost will this give Bashar al-Assad and the Russians?
Well, it will give a boost to the government supporters for sure. That is to say, the people in the westernmost part of the country, the mountainous region between the Mediterranean and Latakia, Tartus on the west, and Homs, Hamas, Damascus in that area in the northwest. However, I noticed that in one of the reports coming, it was either Agence France-Presse or Reuters, it said leaders of the opposition said they do not agree with that assessment, that they think that the government is just as bad as ISIS, and they're opposed to both. And they allegedly represent the Syrian Sunni opposition to the government. You know, my greater concern, Victor, if I may, is will that negatively affect the negotiations that have been going on in Geneva, who have made some progress because, you know, there hasn't been any breakup, and they simply cannot agree in Geneva on the transition. But the very fact that they're meeting and that they're talking is positive. I think if one doesn't make too much of the fall of Palmyra, then negotiations can continue and hopefully lead to an overall cessation.
That is Peter Bechtol. He is a professor at Portland State University. And he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. That cessation of hostilities he just mentioned holds in Syria, even though there are violations and the truce remains a bit shaky. Geneva talks on Syria ended Thursday after 10 days, with the United Nations mediator saying that he was encouraged by the meetings, even though there was, in his words, no drama and no walkouts. Talks are expected to resume next month. Last week's deadly attacks in Brussels, claimed by the Islamic State, have refocused America's attention on terrorism, also elevated the national security subject as a topic, and the U.S. presidential contest. We get the latest now from VOA's Michael Bowman.
As Belgians continue to mourn, protests and security concerns forced a March for Peace to be canceled in Brussels. Across the Atlantic, the attack sparked heated rhetoric on the presidential campaign trail. Republican Ted Cruz pledged to destroy Islamic State.
And we will do that through overwhelming air power, through carpet bombing them into oblivion.
In a telephone interview, Republican frontrunner Donald Trump said the United States is at risk.
Terrorism is out of control. And if we're not very, very strong and very, very smart, we have a big, big problem coming up.
We're going to continue to root out and defeat ISIL.
President Obama said military might alone cannot root out terrorism and that America must lead by example.
Our openness to refugees fleeing ISIL's violence, our determination to win the battle against ISIL's hateful and violent propaganda, a distorted view of Islam that aims to radicalize young Muslims to their cause. In that effort, our most important partners are American Muslims.
That message was echoed by the Democratic frontrunner.
We cannot give in to panic and fear. It's not in keeping with our values. It's not effective in protecting us, and it plays into the hands of terrorists.
Republicans accuse Obama of weakness.
He refuses to say the words radical Islamic terrorism, but instead he lectures us on Islamophobia. Well, enough is enough. Here's what we're going to do with ISIS. We should use overwhelming force, kill the enemy, and then get the heck out.
Democrat Bernie Sanders wants Muslim nations to lead the fight.
Of course, I am opposed to the United States getting involved in perpetual warfare in the Middle East.
After last year's terrorist attacks in Paris, polls showed a spike in American security concerns in an election cycle in which economic themes have otherwise been predominant. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
And you can stay on top of the Brussels attacks, all that information, plus the rest of the news at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
In a number of studies, researchers have outlined the health dangers of sitting too much and its link to the onset of some chronic diseases and early death. Now, a new report in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine suggests sitting for more than 3 hours a day is to blame for 3.8% of all worldwide deaths. The study authors also found that moderate or even vigorous physical exercise might not be enough to offset the negative effects of sitting for too long. They suggest that reducing daily sitting time to less than 3 hours a day could add an average of 0.2 years to a person's life expectancy. The researchers say the link between sitting and death was highest in Western Pacific nations, followed by European, Eastern Mediterranean, American, and then Southeast Asian countries. Lately, more office workers are using workstations that allow them to alternate between sitting and standing throughout the day. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today here on The Voice of America. Bob Dylan's influence on popular music, as we well know, crosses multiple genres. In fact, the impact on country music is particularly important. It's being celebrated in an exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame. It is titled Dylan, Cash, and the Nashville Cats. Nikki Strong of VOA Music spoke with International Edition's Sarah Williams about it all.
Nikki, tell us about Bob Dylan's role in country music.
Okay, well, before Bob Dylan went to Nashville to record, the place was really perceived as being conservative, a southern town, definitely not on the cutting edge of music. And that all changed when Bob Dylan bucked his record label and decided to record there. It opened doors for a slew of other prominent folk rock and pop artists at the time, such as Joan Baez and Paul McCartney and Neil Young, to also visit Nashville to record. And it helped foster a cultural exchange between all of those genres. And because of the high caliber of talent and skill and musicianship of the local session musicians that were there, which were called the Nashville Cats in this exhibit, so to speak, Nashville, or Music City, as they call it now, became a highly respected destination spot to make great music. And it is also this connection that helped make Dylan a major force in the creation of the country rock genre.
What brought Dylan to Nashville?
Okay, so this is the backstory. Dylan was recording with producer Bob Johnston in New York. And Bob Johnston used to live in Nashville, and he invited Charlie McCoy to come up to visit one of Dylan's sessions. And McCoy was a well-respected multi-instrumentalist session musician in Nashville. He came up and played guitar on Dylan's song, Desolation Row. Well, Dylan was so impressed with McCoy's musicianship, so Johnston was like, hey, Bob, there's more, you know, where that came from. You should go down to Nashville to record. And so Dylan did. And in February 1966, he recorded what is considered one of his greatest albums, Blonde on Blonde.
We'll talk about his relationship with Johnny Cash.
Okay, so he and Johnny Cash, the two really bonded at the 1964 Newport Folk Festival. And they met up in Nashville in February of 1969. Dylan had recorded most of Nashville's Skyline at that time when he went into the studio with Cash, and then they cut several duets. One is called Girl from the North Country, and that appeared on Nashville Skyline, and Cash wrote the Grammy-winning liner notes for the album. The exhibit in particular also focuses on how the Johnny Cash show also helped usher in a new era of country music by featuring artists of various genres as well, especially those of the country folk tradition. And Bob Dylan was one of its very first guests. Others include Linda Ronstadt and Joni Mitchell and Kris Kristofferson and Merle Haggard. The list goes on and on.
So Dylan, Cash, and the Nashville Cats, that's the name of the exhibit. The Nashville Cats were the talented session musicians who helped bring the music of so many of these artists to life.
Exactly. So there's like 16 listening booths, and each is devoted to a Nashville Cat of the era. So it's like David Briggs, Kenny Buttry, Fred Carter, Pig Robbins, just to name a few. Each booth provides biographical information, archival photos, audio samples of the musician's signature licks on both country and rock recordings from the late 1960s. And 70s. And there are all kinds of golden nuggets as well as part of the exhibit. Included, there's a manuscript in Dylan and Cash's handwriting for Wanted Man, a song that Dylan wrote for Cash in Nashville for Cash's 1969 album Johnny Cash at San Quentin. Paul McCartney's tape box for the master tapes and track sheets from his 1974 sessions in Nashville are there. There's a guitar and harmonica that Dylan used in the early 1960s. It's going to be a concert from the songs from the Blonde on Blonde album. There's guitar workshops. There's a bunch of fun stuff. And there's also a CD that you can actually purchase as part of the exhibit. You can buy it off Amazon. And the name of the CD is the same title of the exhibit. You can find out all kinds of stuff about the exhibit at countrymusichalloffame.org.
The exhibit is called Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats. It runs until December of 2016 at the Country Music's Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville, Tennessee. You can also hear all kinds of country music on VOA One's Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong. If you're on social media, you can reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music or on Twitter at VOA_music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
The guilty undertaker sighs, the lonesome organ grinder cries, the silver saxophones say I should refuse you. The cracked bells and washed out horns blow into my face with scorn.
You know, 60 years later, that guy is still sounding just like he did 60 years ago. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. Our director is Tracy Carter today. Our engineer is Chaz Hall. I'm Steve Norman. All of us are here in Washington, and we're hoping that you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On World Water Day, March 22nd, the U.S. government, through the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, launched USAID Lowland Wash, a new water, sanitation, and hygiene activity to support the government of Ethiopia's One Wash national program in pastoral areas of Afar, Somali, and Southern Nations, Nationalities, and Peoples regions. The new activity will increase the availability of improved, sustainable drinking water sources, increase access to better sanitation products and services, catalyze enhanced sanitation and hygiene behaviors, and build capacity for enhanced knowledge and data management, while also expanding sustainable water use for agriculture. In the near term, the activity will help respond to the current drought while working to build long-term resilience by helping communities to better manage and use their water resources. Given the magnitude of the current drought, the activity will prioritize well rehabilitation in acutely affected Cabelas. This, in addition to the nearly $10 million in humanitarian aid that the U.S. is providing to improve access to safe drinking water, rehabilitate water systems and sanitation infrastructure, and provide relief items like hygiene kits and water containers. Ethiopia has made dramatic strides over the last 15 years to increase access to improved water and sanitation. Speaking ahead of the launch, Christian Holmes, Global Water Coordinator for USAID, highlighted the importance of the work the new activity will undertake. Safe water and sanitation is what enables a child to grow, learn, and rise out of poverty. It is what keeps communities healthy. USAID's lead partner, AECOM International Development, will implement the $23.8 million activity in cooperation with CARE USA and the International Rescue Committee. Water is life, and the United States is proud to partner with Ethiopia in developing this essential resource for the benefit of all the people of Ethiopia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials. It's